Dialogue Press. And what's the easiest way to do that, Ralph? Your phone number?
Yeah, fax, phone. The easiest thing to do is order it from your local bookstore. That's the best for us.
So I did write down a few questions, which isn't my usual modus operandi, but you stimulated me so much reading the book that I just really want to find out for me what in the world this pushing against the edge of the unthinkable is. And let's talk first, if you will, about the idea of an attractor pulling us towards it.
Oh, yeah. I don't know where we were before we had the word attractor.
I don't either. It's a mathematical term, right?
Yeah, it's quite recent, too, just 30 years or so ago. Of course, the concept undoubtedly existed before. But I think it was René Thom in 1966. He invented, more or less, a completely new style of applied mathematics, completely different from what is traditionally called applied mathematics. And it was based on the words attractor, basin, and bifurcation. Some kinds of bifurcation he called catastrophe theory. So all this came in a package that became known as catastrophe theory. And it excited a great deal of hostility as a kind of heretical new paradigm. And people shot at it and actually killed it. So you do not hear of catastrophe theory anymore, but you do hear about attractors, basins, and bifurcations.
Yes, you use those terms.
They became the standard vocabulary of so-called chaos theory. Attractor, in this mathematical sense, only makes sense, really, in the context of a so-called dynamical system, and that is like a fluid in motion where every point in the space is filled with a particle of fictitious fluid which is streaming along according to rule, going in the legal direction at the legal speed. This abstract model, we can think of history or the society or the progress of a relationship or whatever
as speeding along some non-track towards something we don't know?
Yeah, some invisible tracks are there, which are the mathematical given of this kind of hypothetical model.
We saw last night on television that an old but incredible video on how the sperm and egg meet. Uh-huh. And the sperm go along an invisible track. Mm-hmm. That's actually laid down, and the ones who can't find it, they die right away.
Yeah.
Is that the kind of thing we're talking about? Everything, that all the little quanta in the universe are headed along some track we can't figure out?
Well, any given situation is living in an invisible model. If God is a mathematician, and in this invisible model there are tracks, and then the evolution of the system is just like following a track. This is the fiction called mathematical model, which is not necessarily true or anything. It's just that science is based on it.
Sounds awfully like predestination, the old-fashioned predestination. Is that true? Have choice then?
This is a model in which predestination is built in, as long as the rule doesn't change. But with us, we know that we can like reach outside of our own system and change a knob that changes the rules, and then the whole system of tracks changes into a different system of tracks. And that's what free will is all about. So if we didn't change the tracks, then we're creatures of habit, as it were. And it's in this creatures of habit context, when nobody is changing the rules, that the concept of attractor lives. Getting back to your question, what's an attractor?
Mm-hmm.
So in such a system, where the invisible tracks don't move, were there any such situation that ever followed such a rule, then if you wait a long time, you get to the end of the track. And that's called the attractor.
So it doesn't mean... according to Terence McKenna, the end of the track is 2012?
Well, according to Terence McKenna, I don't think the end of the track is 2012, but he does speak of an attractor at the end of time.
Okay.
And that is a metaphor maybe more general than the one I'm talking about, which is mathematical jargon.
But I interrupted you, and you said, and that doesn't mean...
Well, it doesn't mean that the attractor at the end of time is actually attracting us. It means that if we lived long enough, we just end up there. So thinking
because
of
the
it,
road takes us there automatically. It's like being on one of those automatic roadways they talk about building.
Exactly.
Where you get in your car and you get to where you're going
even
without doing anything.
Even if it's not automatic, if you, mm-hmm. you know, you set out in your car and you're following the road, and nobody's going to come along and suddenly move the road and put in a sharp turn to the left that wasn't there before. So there's more or less a structurally stable map of where you can go and where you can't go in a car, which is a good reason for getting out and walking sometimes. But if you stay in the car, you end up at the end of the road. And that's not, it doesn't mean that the end of the road is pulling the car. It's just that you have accepted the rule that you're going to stay on the road. And that happens to be where the road goes. Therefore, the word attractor, it suggests an interpretation which isn't really justified in the mathematical universe from which that word comes.
So it's more like an automatic destination than an attractor as far as history goes, or
yeah.
lack of history.
If you don't know about the map, then it seems like you're being pulled.
Hmm. Is it okay to say that spirit is guiding us? That we're like a TV, a stereo, a voice that is not really in control, but something of another level.
Yeah, you could call it spirit, but maybe it's just a blueprint that's built into the ether or something. Like we have our destiny, and that's it.
What do you see it as? What does Ralph Abraham see this destiny as?
Well, I don't think that we live in a dynamical system like that at all.
Oh, you don't believe in all of this? Or
well,
this isn't your reality?
I don't believe in the application of this particular model to history, no.
Uh-huh.
No, I never suggested that.
Okay, well, then let's jump tracks.
Shift paradigm.
Yeah, we just reached that knob you talked about. Since that's
yeah.
not the working model at the moment in this room, what is?
Well, the working model that I appeal to, and again, this is very abstract and it's a limited system of metaphors, but it's just a slightly more general picture in which you can reach out and change the knob, and then the rules change, and then the system of where the attractor is or where the attractors are, because there's usually more than one, the whole map changes. And we actually have the ability to change the map, and people are changing the map all the time. And if you think in this way, which might not be justified, but if you want to try it out, then we do have, not only we have some kind of free will, but we even have the guidance of a mathematical theory evolving over a million years, which can give us some guidance as to what the result would be of a free choice. See, free will means, well, we can choose to do anything. Turn to the left or turn to the right. Well, suppose that when you turn to the left, there's a cliff there and you immediately fall down 2,000 feet into the ocean. And when you turn to the right, you reach Valhalla and there's a big banquet going on with nice food. Then you would want to turn one way instead of the other. But if you're uninformed about the outcome, then you might just turn at random, thinking, I'm tired of this road.
Right.
So the idea of appealing to mathematical models at all is just to get the little tiniest bit of guidance as far as what the outcomes would be for the various choices that we have.
What does it show us? What does mathematics show us as the what are the possibilities or probabilities?
Well, in mathematical studies of such systems, there are certain kind of changes that can happen and other kinds that can't happen.
Well, if we go towards what can happen, well, I guess what I'm asking you is...
What it tells us is that when you're in... that these systems have kind of moments of meltdown, and in those moments of meltdown, you have a lot more free choice than otherwise.
Is this such a moment?
Yes.
Aha, has it
that's,
been for
that's
30,
my theory.
40
I mean,
years?
I can't prove it.
Okay.
It maybe has been for a century, yes.
For a century?
Yeah.
Because it's gone so fast with so many differences in the last 100 years.
Yeah, and so many choices and so many moments where a little thing means a lot. where one person or a little group of people strives to do ends up having a huge effect in the long run. Whereas in the long flat spots of history, you can try until you're blue in the face and nothing happens. So what happened to us in the 1960s?
We took psychedelics.
We experienced a miracle.
Right.
And that culture changed instantly without effort. We were praying for a miracle, and then something happened, and then it was all different, and it was wonderful for a while.
Yes.
And we didn't know before that what we ought to do to make it come out like that.
That's true. We still don't, do we?
It was a serendipitous. No, we have no idea what to do.
Right.
But one thing you have to do is to get that meltdown state, such as psychedelics and the surrounding spirit field, whatever it was that we created or that created us or that had to do with our all being on the same frequency at the same time. That spirit field was a kind of a meltdown situation where altruistic ideas could lead forward and guide the evolution of a new society. We made a new society not intentionally, but the way it came out was very paradisical. And that was because we had some kind of altruistic good spirit, like we wanted well for other people. We were guided by the feeling of love more than by the word love, which was bandied about extensively. And you can't say what the word means, but there was a feeling in the air that I would say it was the materialization of this special kind of energy that
we had
means.
Experienced something that was beyond love, that was love in its ultimate unity somehow or other, and we wanted to get that manifest on a lot of different planes of reality, including the most mundane. How did that work?
So that's our experience of the actuality of the kind of change that we now want for the entire planet society
right on
a global scale.
Yeah.
And although we don't know how to produce it and we don't know how it was produced, we know that this kind of thing is possible.
Tell us about the role of the World Wide Web. I'm sorry, I keep interrupting you because I got so much I want to ask.
Because I'll go on forever if you don't interrupt me. The World Wide Web is yet another level of integration of human species into something like a termite hive.
Okay.
Or a swarm of bees.
Right. Unity.
Now, unity. Now, we should be united by spirit alone. It seems like it's enough. We know that stuff like telepathy, precognition, intuition, this is real for us. And yet it's hard to extend it all the way around the planet. But it should be. Some people, it seems like they're tuned out of the spirit network.
They've never tapped into it.
They've never tapped into it, and partly because they believe it doesn't exist, they can't experience it, and then because they can't experience it, they believe it doesn't exist, and there's some kind of spiral there that it's hard to get out of. And one way out is psychedelics, and another is 150 years of austerity in the jungle, and another way is the World Wide Web, because it gives us... it shrinks the dimension of the planet and extends the sphere, the radius of our sphere of sympathy, so that the number of people that we can be sympathetic with is vastly increased by the ability to instantly communicate with them through speech. I mean, speech is not everything, but it's enormously powerful in terms of making these bonds. So the World Wide Web has tied together the human enterprise into a much smaller, compact ball of intercommunicating stuff, and therefore has magnified unity of the human species.
It's wiped out the borders.
It's wiped out the borders, and governments
politics.
Are totally obsolete.
Yeah.
Now they go around posturing like they still matter. And on some level, of course, they do matter. I mean, they'll put you in jail for carrying the wrong stuff or whatever. And but in terms of the human family getting it on a global scale, governments are obsolete. And the World Wide Web, of course, could fail because governments could decide they don't want a planetary society.
Well, they're going to get one whether they want it or not, so it doesn't matter.
Well, it looks optimistic at the moment. We can never take things for granted. People are still out there on the front lines fighting for the freedom of the World Wide Web. And there's all these groups that are trying to radically curtail it, including the United States government. So we don't know how it will turn out, but potentially the World Wide Web is a huge ally in the direction of more or less extending the 1960s in California to the whole world.
That's fabulous. You talked in the beginning of the book about computer graphics, which has been a field of yours, I know. How does that fit into the evolutionary process and the World Wide Web and the kind of communication we have now?
Well, when you talk about landscape paintings or something, you can't really say that computers are very good at it. Right now, they aren't. Maybe they never will be good at landscape painting and painting portraits and so on. But one thing that computers are really good at is painting landscapes from the mathematical universe. So it's possible with computer graphics to make paintings, to visualize images from inner space, which you couldn't do with a paintbrush
or a camera. Or anything.
Yeah, so since mathematical models make the pictures on computer screens, and mathematical models are good models for our inner visions, it's possible to a degree to exteriorize an inner vision that has a mathematical basis into a little movie that people all over the world can look at and share. So this is just one aspect of the computer revolution, is making mathematics visible.
So in one sense, are you, and by the way, Patty, just interrupt when you need to, because you know I'm as verbal as Ralph. In one sense, are you saying that it's possible for us through computer graphics to create a language that's non-words, in which we can actually share and our inner experiences, because words have been so difficult for us? It's hard to describe, for instance, the mystical experience, the psychedelic experience, or the meditative experience in words. Is this a way of making that communication happen? And how much would, suppose I wanted to communicate to Patrick or anyone, how much would they have to know in the way of mathematics to be able to grok, as it were, what I'm trying to tell them in this graphic?
Well, what you see on the screen is mathematics.
It is mathematics.
Because mathematics is the study of space-time patterns.
Is that what it is?
So you see a little movie on the screen, you're seeing mathematics, and if you can kind of recognize it, then you're exercising your innate, God-given mathematical talent, which is something like walking, that just about everybody can do it. You catch a ball, for example, that means understanding a space-time pattern in an intuitive way, reacting appropriately, and that's the mathematician in you that can dance or catch a ball or wash the dishes without breaking them and so on. So what you see on the screen is mathematics, and to the degree to which it's a meaningful mathematical object, that is space-time pattern or a little movie, then it would be recognized as such, because it looks vaguely familiar, looks similar to space-time patterns that you've seen elsewhere in nature. So it's possible with computer graphics to share some inner experiences, visual ones, but not all inner experiences, like emotions, feelings, and the idea of the divine, and impressions that you get that you feel sure are true and shared by everybody, that you would like to be able to draw a picture and hand it to them, and they would get the idea. You can't with computer graphics. Not that.
So this is not a way to reach those people who have not tapped into the spiritual realm.
Maybe some people. It's like poetry. You know, poets have a way with words, and they can say things that can't be said, so that an innocent person somewhere who hears those words finds evoked within themselves a whole thing which is beyond words, that there's some resonance process where the little tiny remnant, like a photograph is a remnant of a piece of life, that you look at the photograph of some old birthday party, you remember the people, the smells, the feelings, and so on, by some kind of resonance process, what's not in the picture is remembered within. And it could be that the computer graphic representation of a visual that could have accompanied a spiritual experience could in itself evoke in someone a spiritual experience, like eating the wafer at communion.
Right.
Does actually, for some people, I experienced this myself.
Really?
With great surprise that I had an epiphany upon taking by accident, more or less, the wafer in my mouth.
My goodness.
So, by such miraculous means, I think that all communication depends on miraculous means. When I'm speaking and you're understanding my idea much better than I'm speaking it. You know, because there's sort of a telepathy, which is modulated.
Right.
It's like the speech is the carrier wave of a telepathy, I think. And so the computer graphics might be the carrier wave of telepathy, where God is actually speaking through this machine, as it were, in the universal language of mathematics.
Poetry is actually, to my mind, a bridge between music, which is another nonverbal way of communicating. I don't know how it fits into mathematics, but a lot of mathematicians are musicians, and vice versa. So there's that. In the book, you speak a lot about language. I was thinking of Laurie Anderson's song, Languages of Iris. She's got a song called Languages of Iris. It seemed to me that that's what you were handling, language as something that alienates us, keeps us socked into a time-space reality where we feel separated from each other, and that there must be better ways of communicating. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. You know, language is a kind of a new acquisition of human species. And without doubt, it suppressed our other communicating skills. I mean, Laurie Anderson is one of those really like-minded people out there.
Yes, she is.
And you know, Plato said he was afraid that writing would destroy memory, and that's true, that people used to be able to memorize the Vedas and speak them. Some people still do recite the Vedas every morning, and probably our capability for remembering long stories was reduced by writing, but that's good in a way because it frees up the apparatus for something else. But certainly the acquisition of spoken language greatly depreciated our other skills, and animals still have them. So the degree to which, the ways in which we communicate with animals, either pets or domesticated animals, farm animals, and wild animals, these ways are derivative of what used to be our primary communication channels.
Yeah. It seems to me like academia, our Western educational system, has some merits. However, it seems that we get locked into just a small portion of who we are, and we become prisoners of language and writing, and we lose a lot of the telepathic or intuitive or spiritual connection to each other and the universe.
Well, we have visual arts and sculptures and architecture, and especially, as Elizabeth said, music, which are nonverbal communication means that we use very extensively and that succeed. We haven't lost them. In fact, they seem to be developing rapidly now because of television and computer graphics and so on, that a kind of visual language is blooming now, which is not going to replace spoken language, but essentially augment it through larger means.
Seemed in the book as though time-space is an enemy to us rather than a delight, and that some of the things that you've mentioned now might carry us beyond time-space and whatever the eschaton is, or wherever this road is taking us, if indeed it is a road, that we'll be able to communicate in totally different ways. I can't even imagine not thinking in words. That's beyond my imagination. Your book is certainly a paean to words, to head tripping with words, right? How do you feel about the trilogues as far as their meaning? Well, gosh, I'm asking too many questions at once. How about time space? Is that going to stop at some point in your mathematical vision? Are we going to continue to exist? Are we going to get, well? I mean, I'm sliding here towards death, but are we going to continue to exist in a time space universe here? I don't know how to ask it, even obviously, but
well, I don't think, just my personal view, you know, I don't have any evidence, but I think that space time is probably taken too seriously, and that it's some kind of psychological artifact. It's a machine limitation of our incarnated system. And we have some evidence. Physical theory, for example, sees space as having a lot more dimensions than we experience psychologically moving around. Or color. We perceive color as a three-dimensional space because of the physiology of our eyes. And there's nothing real about this three-dimensionality. It's just a perceptual artifact. So it could be that the illusion of the three-dimensional space that we move through is a kind of an artifact. And the science is always greedily using up more dimensions. You know, there's physical space, there's temperature, there's attributes like the color of light, the density of light, the density of matter, the motion of matter. I mean, there are all these dimensions. There's like wormholes, there's strings, these are just theories, but the physicists don't feel comfortable with three dimensions, just not really enough space for them to do that magic trick in. So it could be that space is there. There is space, but it's much richer than what we perceive of it. And similarly, time, it could be, since we have precognitive dreams, I mean, precognitive dreams are, I would say, proved as much as any scientific fact is proved. And what that means that the conventional idea of time is all wrong, and that at least some cloudy aspect of the future already exists as we speak, and it will materialize, firm up more or less as we approach it in ordinary psychological time, then that future will gradually become more and more the present that it's going to be. Mm-hmm. That must be true. So our conventional idea of time is much too limited. Conventional idea of space is much too limited. And there might be a real space and time that we don't perceive directly too well, but we do get a lot of information from it, without which we couldn't even survive. We couldn't find food. We couldn't drive around the corner without getting killed in the car, you know. So if accepting the existence of some kind of space-time, and that our idea of it is too limited, then our idea of it as a species, as we go down the centuries into the future, might evolve so that we're like gawking more of it and using that and the intelligence of it essentially for our survival on the planet.
So evolution in that case, that's great. Evolution in that case would be the ability to experience and integrate more and more realities, as it were, or more and more levels of the reality, so that all of it would be enhanced.
Yeah, well, this is a greedy dream. We
I
want
like
more.
It.
You know,
we
so
want
this
more,
is sort
right?
of what we mean dream. By the evolutionary mind is the mind, is the collective mental field, not only of our species, but all species and inanimate and the biosphere and the universe as a conscious mental thing, rather outside of its material, mass, mechanistic, you know what, that thing, that biggest mind you can conceive of, is evolving. And in its evolution, we are a kind of a nutritional system.
Oh,
our lifetimes are being eaten, and our stuff digested and made into more mind. So the more creative we want to be, then we're contributing to this monster, as it were, which is the entire existing universe.
Okay, go ahead.
Monster is suggesting its size.
Size, somehow. Yes.
And as far as its good intentions, we are not really sure.
Right, we don't know. But what you're saying, if I can reinterpret it, so to be sure that I understand, is that there's a two-way system going on of feeding information. We're feeding into some larger complex that we can experience sometimes with psychedelics, meditation, drumming, whatever. And it's feeding us back.
Yeah.
And that we're both, all of the evolution is all the way up and down from, I call it God, I don't know what to call it.
Yeah, well, this is the fantasy of evolution, or let's say creativity, is that we actually can create more, that creation is happening, that we're part of the evolution of the all and everything, that our creativity is part of it, that we're participating in the co-evolutionary system, and we're not just riding a horse which is evolving with its own intention of where it's going and so on.
So it's like, that's the knob that you spoke of early on.
Yeah, that's why
that's
it matters what you think. It matters what you do. And if you think it doesn't matter and you commit suicide, then even that matters.
Everything matters.
Yeah. And so we might as well go ahead trying to make the most beautiful and wonderful future that we can think of. And that means that there's a responsibility in the present. If what you do matters, if there could be a beautiful future and our creativity is feeding it, then we have the responsibility to actually get out and do something, and it matters what we do, and therefore we have to think about what we do, and we have to be informed by the best knowledge of history, mathematics, philosophy, religion, spiritual experience, shamanism, and so on. And then with this feeble bag of knowledge, which is all we've got, we have to do our best to create that future, which is the potential. It's the potentializing of the infinite, including
wow,
the future. And so we have to go around doing things like politics in the present, like recycling, and like all this stuff matters enormously. And this might not be true, but if it's true, then life is more fun. So we might as well go as if it's true. It's like, who was that who believed in God because it was safer?
I don't know. But that's
me. I want to ask you, what would you offer to the audience listening? What needs to be done? What's essential to create this beautiful paradise?
Well, we have to change the educational system.
Yeah.
We have to guard against the evil tendency of television, just for example, which is not inherent in the medium, but is, you know, the entertainment industry, the economic, short-term economic motives, all that people are talking about, futurists, and so everybody's discussing what is the trouble, and there are all these popular books, many of them have good ideas, how you work on yourself individually, you work on your neighborhood level, you think globally and act locally, you try to prevent corruption in government, in logging practice, in the discharge of noxious gases and greenhouse gases into the environment, you try to clean up the mess that's been made already, you stop denying and pretending that there's no such thing as nuclear waste, and that you take all these things seriously and do what you can, and this is an enormous responsibility and too much to think about, and nobody wants to deal with it. So there is this ostrich function, I think, which is might even be the most basic root of the whole complex of problems, is the denial function. So we have to think about denial. We have to inform ourselves with the pop psychology of denial, just for example. And we have to do therapy on ourselves as a society, as a city, as a state, as a nation, as a planetary society, to try to understand the evil that's within, that manifests in the destruction of the environment and the dispotentialization of the future.
It isn't. I feel it isn't the technology. A lot of my friends, we just got the most amazing letter, Ralph, yesterday from an old friend of mine. He's 84 now. He's been living in a teepee above Kovalo for years. He said, this is goodbye. I'm going to find a South Pacific island. At 84, it's my 84th birthday. He said, I'm going to find a South Pacific island where there's no Safeway, there's no laundromat, there's no technology. Of course, that's impossible because from the time a chimpanzee takes a stone and crushes some ants or something, technology happens. If I hear you correctly, what we need to do is not deny technology, but work on ourselves so that we use technology humanely.
Yeah, we can't make it out of here without technology.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's not technology that is the problem, it's ignorance.
Ignorance.
And that's why I think the emphasis on schools. See, we don't have time to re-educate adults like ourselves and try to do something that society of the future has got to bootstrap itself basically right out of the cradle, right out of the womb. And we need a cultural change. It would have to occur in people of all ages simultaneously, not just like in the 60s of people in between 16 and 46 or whatever it was. And the school system, on the other hand, was created or evolved itself. It organized itself into a system of like carbon rods and nuclear reactors of resisting change, resisting creativity, resisting evolution. That's the mechanism, like the church used to be, for maintaining culture as it is, which is a valuable function, generally speaking. But now that we're in the emergency situation where we need our anti-society planet-wide to take a sharp turn to the left because we're on this death track, we have to find a way to turn off this governing, regulating system that the educational system has become.
I don't see how we can... See, there's it's not a spiral at that point, it's a circle. How do adults who are ignorant create a new educational system? I know you were working on that.
Yeah.
Weren't you redesigning it? Designing a new educational system?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. Designs are only useful to the degree to which you can
implement
them, and that's been a very frustrating experience for me personally. It's given me more the idea of what this educational system is in its rigidity and so on. Other places have better educational systems, but they're equally rigid. They're just not so needful of change, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Like the European system from over the whole of Europe, I think, is vastly superior to our educational system.
In what way?
In the degree to which it transmits knowledge to the students.
Hmm. A different methodology or different knowledge?
A different methodology.
Of teaching?
Different success rate.
A different success rate.
Yeah, it's not even the methodology. It's more, I think, the attitude that's built into the culture or something.
Well, to get back to trialogues, which is we're trying to encourage people to read because I think it's a great book. What are fractal boundaries and how do they limit us? I didn't understand quite what a fractal. I understand what a fractal is. Let me tell you, and then you tell me I'm wrong. That would be a fractal is like everything in the universe is a small model of everything else. Is that right or wrong?
Well, I don't know. You could think of it that way, but I'm thinking of it more as like fractal geometry is a new kind of. It's like postmodern geometry. It's post-Euclidean geometry. So Euclidean geometry has got like these sharp lines
mm-hmm.
that here and there are divided by a sharp line,
right.
Wall, membrane, or whatever.
Right.
And the fractal object that's like a line is porous. For example, you have the Earth is made of dirt is made of clumps. And in between the clumps is non-dirt. And in the non-dirt in the airspace between two clumps, there are some smaller clumps. And between those smaller clumps is more non-dirt. And so there's this porosity, and then water can get through. So like you water the garden, and the water goes inside, and then the airspace filled with water. So there's the water succeeded in getting through the dirt boundary between the above and the below ground. See, so this is the important functional aspect of fractal boundaries, is that they're porous, and they bind like a net. Like a hay net, you put the hay in the hay net and it stays there, it doesn't fall out. But when the horse wants to eat it, it just pulls it out. So the boundaries are more optional. Mm-hmm. As they say in Italy, we regard laws as suggestions.
That's nice. That's what Patty's always said about Moses.
The Ten Commandments, I've always said, are really ten suggestions.
They are, yeah. Suggestions actually have a great weight of... they have great power to regulate, mm-hmm. as much as laws do.